Hi, I'm George, and you're listening to Uncle Steve Iron Maiden's Own. Yeah! Woo! As we go somewhere back in time with my dad, Andrew. Come on, Uncle Steve, the show's about to start.
Alright, welcome to episode 58 of Uncle Steve's Iron Maiden Zone. And yes, you heard it right, as my friend from Down Under, Georgie, said. This week we are going somewhere back in time with his dad, the Weekend Warrior himself, the man of many, many nicknames, Andrew Whitnall, who lives in Melbourne or near Melbourne, Australia. Now, have you ever listened to an Iron Maiden song and wondered what the song was about? I mean, sure, war, something like that. But have you ever wondered what the song was really about, the details of maybe a specific event that inspired the song? Well, if so, you are in for a real treat, as Andrew and I are starting a series about such things called, you guessed it, Somewhere Back in Time. You will hear all the details from Andrew in just a few minutes. You are really, really going to enjoy this. And just a heads up on the series, it's not going to be every single week because, as you will hear, it takes a good bit of research to get the information. But, alas, you will be getting a series from me and Georgie's dad. Now you're probably thinking, wait a minute, this is already going into the episode, but no, I have something different for you. A little change. So right now I'm going to share who shared the last episode that I did, episode 57, Blaze Bailey, War Within Me, my interview with Blaze. It was shared by the Liverpool Scousers, Don McIntyre and Stephanie Jane Gray, Dean Longenecker from Columbia, South Carolina, Alan Bell from Scotland, Hedard Ferran from Montreal, Canada, Luis Mariano in Venezuela, the Sassenach in Falkirk, UK, my buddy Andy, Eric in Kuwait, Kirsty in Perth, Australia, Reggie Oz in Melbourne, Australia, Sonia Whitnall's husband near Melbourne, Australia, Steve in Oregon, Melissa in Boston, and my buddy Feckin over at the Feckin Metal Podcast out of Ireland. And just in case you missed it, he also interviewed Blaze Bailey. Matter of fact, we figured out that we actually talked to him back to back. Blaze hung up with me, and the next guy on the phone with him was Feckin. What a lucky guy that Blaze is, right? I mean, I think, yeah, probably not. All right. Lastly, if you have not already, go over to blazebailey.co.uk, and that's Bailey, B-A-Y-L-E-Y, blazebailey.co.uk, and pre-order his new album, War Within Me, which is due out in April. I've been able to listen to it. I know Feckin has been able to listen to it. We both agree. It's a really, really good album. So go over there. Do Blaze a favor. Pre-order it. Do yourself a favor. Get yourself some metal. All right. Let's get on with the show. All right. I have a very special guest on the line with me this week. We're going to go into something that I think you people that listen to my podcast are going to find very, very cool. I know I'm very excited about it, and I'm going to let my friend here. Now, here's the thing. When I introduce this guy, he has a lot of nicknames, one of which is a brand new one I just gave him recently. The man of many nicknames. You might have heard of him as the Weekend Warrior, Georgie's dad, Sonia's husband, or maybe you've even heard of him as Andrew. But I have the Weekend Warrior himself, Andrew, all the way from Australia. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Steve?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. I appreciate you coming on here because you've got a really cool thing to tell everybody about that we're about to do right now, and I'm going to go ahead and pass it over to you right away.
Okay. Well, we've talked about this a little while ago, and you were looking for other people to get involved, and I suggested, well, perhaps we could look at the history behind some of Iron Maiden songs, mm-hmm. Because there are quite a few songs that are historically based. Mm-hmm. And so I suggested doing something like this, giving it a title, Somewhere Back in Time, just like the tour back in 2008.
Excellent.
And we'll go through a song, choose a song, and go through, to the best of my humble abilities, the history behind that song. And hopefully base it on some of the lyrics that are in the song.
Yeah. And you have a, you're very interested in history. So
I am, yes.
So this is right up your alley. And it, one of the things that I will say, one of the things that when you told me about it, cause I was just like, okay, look, I'm not that smart of a guy. I don't know a lot of, I love history. I love hearing about history, but I just don't know a lot about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And you immediately said, look, I'll do all the research. And I said, oh, so I can just play the dumb guy. And you said, yeah. I said, okay, I can do that.
Yes. I'm not sure who's the fool. It was me volunteering to do all the research.
Well, that's the only way this was going to happen.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
But I really do appreciate you, coming up with the idea. Cause I remember as soon as I saw the message from you, I was just like, oh, wow, that's going to be good because, I mean, you know, we've all heard about the different historical events and, you know, at least to a degree. And I think this will be a cool insight. Now, I don't know how often we're going to do them because I'm sure – how much research did you have to do? How much time do you think you spent?
I did a bit. I listened to several podcasts about it. I've learned about these events since I was at school. So there's okay. Lot of residual knowledge that's still in there, okay. But it's always good to go back and do the research again and refresh your memory.
Oh yeah. Well, I believe that people, myself included, I believe we're all in for a treat. This is going to be a lot of fun learning. I mean, I'm really excited to do about this because my show's had a lot of the same type of things on it for a while. And this is something brand new. And like you said, somewhere back in time. Excellent. Excellent.
Okay.
So why don't we go ahead and I'm going to let you are in the driver's seat here. So I'm going to be riding shotgun over here. So take it away.
Well, we've gone for The Longest Day from the Matter of Life and Death album, an album that we both know and love very well. Yes. And it's one of my post-reunion albums. It's one of my favorite songs of all of them. Okay. And, of course, it's The Longest Day refers to the events of the 6th of June, 1944, D-Day, with the Allied invasion of northern France to liberate Europe from Nazi Germany. Now, I'm assuming that people know about World War II. But you can't always assume everything. So let's have a little bit of a brief overview. Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, and Britain and France declared war on Germany as a result. And Germany, of course, invaded France as well as the Low Countries, Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg. Mm-hmm. And unlike in World War One, where the German advance was halted, and the trenches of the Western Front gave a long 4-year almost stationary war. In 1940, the Germans basically swept through France fairly quickly. And there's an important event in May 1940, Dunkirk, where the British Expeditionary Force, the Allies, had to desperately leave continental Europe and return to Britain. And about a third of a million Allied troops were successfully evacuated at Dunkirk. Okay. A retreat, but a very successful one, because a few years later, a lot of those men will be returning back to Europe to help liberate the continent.
Question?
And yes?
Already?
Yes.
I'm in class. I got my hand up over here.
You just popped in.
Yeah. Dunkirk was that a battle?
Obviously there was fighting, yes, but it was a retreat. So lots of little ships, they were coined. So not just naval vessels, but lots of private vessels went over to Dunkirk, which is a port on the very, very northern end of France. You can't get any further north in France, basically. Okay. And it's near the Belgian border. And there was a small area which was completely surrounded by the Germans. And very bravely, the French defended the area. It was mainly French defenders, whilst the British could leave. And of course, many French were able to leave as well. And they all largely stayed in the United Kingdom for 4 years before they could return.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and after Dunkirk, that was then the Battle of Britain. Now, who knows? We might come to the Battle of Britain in due course, because that's, of course, the battle that Aces High is based on. And that ran through from July to October 1940. Now, the key thing about the Battle of Britain is that the British won the Battle of Britain, and that basically put an end to German plans of invasion of Britain. And after that, Germany turned its face eastwards. And in 1941, they invaded the Soviet Union. And that was a long, hard battle over there in the east. And, of course, there was fighting going on, all over the place, North Africa, and of course, in 1941, Japan enters the war with their attack on Pearl Harbor, which resulted, of course, in the United States entering the war.
I've heard of that
Germany,
one.
Yes, after Germany declared war on the United States.
Yeah.
And of course, December 1941 was when that happened. And in January 1942 were the first American troops arrived in the UK to prepare for an invasion. So the invasion plan started really early. And it was there were plans to defend Britain from a German invasion, and they were war-gamed by the British command, and they basically turned those plans around and started to work on an invasion plan of northern France. Are we okay so far?
You probably lost me a little bit, but you're naming a lot of different countries and a lot of different things, but
I'm coming to that.
You're so just getting started, right?
I thought we'll get a bit of context.
Yeah, for sure. And the blue, the gathering storm, the bates and the ships, gimlet eyes away. Long, the drills to build the machine to turn men from flesh and blood to steel, from paper soldiers to bodies on the beach, from summer sands to Armageddon's reach.
The English Channel is the body of water that divides the island of Great Britain from continental Europe. And it is 350 miles long, 150 miles wide at its western end, but only 21 miles wide at the Straits of Dover at the eastern end.
Okay.
You can stand, as I have done on the cliff tops at Dover Castle, and look across the channel, and you can quite clearly see the coast of France. There are stories that you can stand there with a pair of binoculars and read the time on the town hall clock in Calais across the other side of the channel. I'm not sure how true that is, but it's certainly close enough to quite clearly see. And the channel is, if you like, the if a physical a geographic feature can define a nation, the channel really does define England and the English, because it both separates us from our continental friends and is a moat, if you like, of our castle to defend us against potential invaders. But it's also a highway. It's been a way of communication for thousands of years. We can go back to Celtic times, Roman invasion back nearly 2,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and there's been a whole series of tos and fros, different invaders going one way and then others coming back the other way. So it's I grew up near a town called Rye, and I can remember hearing stories about the history of that town on the south coast of England being burnt to the ground by French raiders back in, I think it was the 13th century.
Oh, wow.
So, it's a good to and fro. And then at the same time, you hear tales of smuggling going across. So the actual people would have been very familiar with those on the other side, because the amount of both legal and illegal trade that would have gone across the channel had been going on for hundreds of years. So it's a very important body of water, and it probably contributes to the English psyche of being sort of European but not really part of Europe, if you see what I mean, or the other way around, part of Europe but not thinking that we're part European.
Sure.
Anyway, so when you look at D-Day itself and what the journey that the troops would have taken from Portsmouth to Caen, which is the port in Normandy, where the invasion took place, is about 125 miles. And on a modern ferry, it takes about 5 hours. So if you're not in a modern ferry, if you're in a flat-bottomed troop-carrying craft, landing craft, it would have been an incredibly uncomfortable journey. You would have been in there for hours and hours and hours, and it would not have been a smooth sail across.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yes. So the time it took to prepare for D-Day was quite a long time. You had over a year of exercises that took place in southern England. So you had the Americans coming over, and they based themselves in the southwest England, and in southeast England you already had the British and the Canadians, and so the operations took place in those areas. And one of the most notorious, if you like, operations was Operation Tiger, which took place on the coast of Devon, where during this very secret training exercise for D-Day, you had the Americans practicing their landing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, a German E-boat just happened to be in the area. And, yes, and in the resulting attack, 750 U.S. servicemen were killed. Mm. It contributes largely to a quite surprising statistic that probably as many servicemen were killed in the practice runs leading up to D-Day as were killed on D-Day itself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite a shocking statistic. But without the constant need for practice and practice and practice and getting everything perfect and everything right, it would not have been a success. Everybody had to know exactly what they had to do on the day, and unfortunately there was a great cost to that, the end result was a successful operation, of course. So I'll give you the overview of what happened on the day, or the beaches, because we have the British, the Canadians, and the Americans, and they were all divided up into five different beaches. Okay. And if you just take your left fist. If you're having a fist, you've got your four fingers, and you stick your thumb up against your forefinger.
Yeah.
And you go from your thumb, and that represents the Normandy coast, your fist, and your thumb is the Cotentin Peninsula. It's a peninsula that has the port of Cherbourg on the top of it. And at the base of that peninsula was Utah Beach, where Americans landed. Okay. Next to that, your forefinger is Omaha Beach, which is the famous one, if you like, as far as the American landings were concerned.
Yeah.
Next to that, your middle finger is Gold Beach, where the British landed, around the port town of, or the coastal town of Aramanche. Your ring finger is Juneau, where it was mainly Canadians, and your little finger is Sword, which was another British beach right at the eastern end. They basically were divided up because that's where troops were based in Britain. The Americans were in the west and the British Canadians were in the east. So that's why they divided it up as like that. Now, the invasion should have taken place on the 5th of June in 1944, but there was a storm. And if you look at the first line of The Longest Day, in the gloom, the gathering storm abates. We had the storm on the 5th of June, which did abate just enough for them to say, we can go on the 6th of June. Now, they chose that period because there was a full moon and a low tide, and they needed the full moon certainly for the airborne part of the invasion. They were landing paratroopers and gliders, and they wanted a low tide so that the landing craft did not hit any, or it would be best to avoid any obstacles that could have been covered by a high tide. So they wanted a nice bit of space for everybody to get onto the beaches and advance without it all getting too crowded.
Sure.
But The Gathering Storm also has another reference, and it's Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, wrote a history of World War II, and the first volume of which was called The Gathering Storm. And I reckon that's why that particular phrase was used.
Sure,
Because it is a reference to Churchill. And of course, further on in you have All Summer's Long, the drills to build the machine. Now it's summers. I take to mean multiple summers, and so it was years of planning. Really meticulous. Every single detail was gone over time and time again until everybody knew exactly what they needed to do and every possibility was allowed for. Oh my Lord, your master. We have the invasion taking place on the 6th of June, and like I say, it's a long way. It's 125 miles by sea to get across, and in really, really basic landing craft, and I can't imagine how those men must have felt on that day, sailing across through the night, across the channel. The storm had abated, but it wasn't a nice, perfect summer's day by any means. So it would not have been a pleasant experience at all. And I think when you go through the second verse, when it's basically describing, these wretched souls puking, shaking fear to take a bullet for those who sent them here. That really, the description in that, I take that's come from the film Saving Private Ryan. That's very, a lot of the description in the song comes from that, the opening sequences of that movie, which were very graphic. And I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes, that is one I've actually seen.
Yeah, good.
I haven't seen a lot of movies, but I did see that in the theater, and it's very, very.
It's very well extremely done. Confronting, and of course the title of the song comes from a book in 1959 called "The Longest Day," and the subsequent film that was made, which was called "The Longest Day," which so the book was by Cornelius Ryan, and the film was starring the likes of John Wayne and Richard Burton and Sean Connery and Robert Mitchum. So it was a star-packed film, and I remember watching that. I've watched that several times. I watched it was when I was a little boy, and it seemed that in when I was growing up, it seemed like every weekend there was a war movie of one description or another, and The Longest Day was certainly one of my favourites.
Okay.
So the song really does paint that picture, from that film Saving Private Ryan. Now, that movie was concentrating on the events that took place on one beach, which is Omaha Beach. Mm-hmm. And Omaha Beach is quite notorious. It is the beach where most of the casualties occurred on the day itself.
Omaha Beach.
Yes. Okay. Yes. It was, it was relatively well defended compared to the other beaches. There are some cliffs there that, but the actual, The landing took place at around 6:30, and a lot of the worst and most intense fighting took place in that first hour and a half, 2 hours period.
Yeah.
Once that initial landing had took place, and once the defences had been broken, the rest followed on relatively straightforward. It's been estimated there are about 3,500 allied deaths rather on D-Day itself, with about 10,000 casualties in total.
Okay.
It was planned for and expected to have as much as 20,000 deaths on the day itself. So it really was in terms of the casualties that were taken, it was a successful day.
Yeah.
And with each beach taking between 700 and 1,000 deaths. Now, I mean, we look at it today and we think that's an extraordinary number.
Yeah.
But in the context of the Second World War, of course, that would be considered to be a real success.
And that was just on the Allied side?
That's just on the Allied side, okay. Yes. Okay. I think that the figures for German deaths, casualties, were a lot. And not quite as concrete as those, and I can't recall off the top of my head what they were. But the D-Day itself was just one day. The Battle for Normandy, which is the name Overlord, which that first word in the second verse, Overlord, okay. Your master, not your god. Overlord refers to the operation. The Battle of Normandy was Operation Overlord, and within that there were other operations. So Operation Neptune was the seaborne invasion, for example, but Overlord was for the whole Battle of Normandy, which was a 77-day battle to basically, once you've won Normandy, then Paris wasn't far away. And you have that 77 long day battle for Normandy, and the very end of that, you've got on the 25th of August, you have the liberation of Paris, which really is a major achievement in a relatively short space of time.
Yeah,
on the way, that was the Allies had a lot of good fortune on the day itself. So you had in command of the German defences and the coast of France, as the coast of all of occupied Europe, was what was called the Atlantic Wall. It was a whole long series of defences that were designed to defend the occupied territories from seaborne invasion. So you had along the, like, it wasn't a physical wall all the way. It was a series of gun emplacements, of bunkers, and the various forms of defences that were designed to protect the whole of the coast from invasion. And of course, Normandy was quite heavily defended. The Germans didn't actually have a real idea as exactly where the Allies were going to land. So you have a coastline that offers several possibilities of where they could land, and this area being one of them. But, of course, the most obvious one is the one that's nearest to Britain, which is up near the port of Calais. And there was a whole series of operations that took place to divert German attention away from Normandy and give them the impression that the Allies were going to land near Calais.
That's wild.
And even once the invasion had started, the German command, a lot within the German command, still thought that Normandy was a diversion, that the real invasion was coming at Calais, and they were reluctant to commit all their troops to Normandy because they thought they would be just basically opening the back door to an Allied invasion into Calais. So it took them a while before they realized that, no, this really is the invasion. This is where it's happening. Yes. So you have the commander, which is Field Marshal Rommel, who was a very famous German commander. He was known as the Desert Fox for his, what he'd done in North Africa. And he had eventually been defeated in North Africa by a British general, Montgomery. And the Germans were pushed out of North Africa. And he was given command of the defences in northern France, but he happened to be in Germany at that very moment because I think it was his wife's birthday. So he decided to take a few days off and go back home. And his second in command, I think, was having a bit of a party, and he was drunk the morning of D-Day.
Oh, wow.
And the crack panzer division, 21st Panzer, which the German armored division, the tanks, etc., their commander was enjoying the company of a young lady in Paris.
That
the evening before.
they were just really well prepared.
They had their eyes well and truly off the ball.
Yeah.
And now, that doesn't necessarily matter in some respects, because some of these people in the German command were not particularly good at their job. And the panzers were the ones that the British in particular were very worried about, because they were down near Caen, which is where the British were trying to attack. And there was a very important – there's a river and a canal. Now, this is very important to D-Day, because they wanted to capture the bridges over the canal, the Caen Canal and the River Orne. And they had to do that first before anything else took place. That what they did, they landed paratroopers and gliders. Gliders landed near in the dead of night near the bridges, and the parachute regiment captured the bridges. And there's a little cafeteria right next to what is now known as Pegasus Bridge across the Caen Canal. And that was the first house to be liberated in France. And it's still there. And the bridge is still there, although the bridge has since been replaced by a modern replica. But those bridges were captured, and they had to be held for hours and hours and hours until the troops that landed at Sword Beach had advanced far enough to relieve them. Meanwhile, 21st Panzer were preparing to attack and retake the bridges, which they may well have done. But history, unfortunately, doesn't tell us that, because they were told, forget that, because then they realized there's landings going on the beaches. We want you to divert directly to the beaches and not attack the bridges. And the only way they could do that was to go through the city of Caen. So they had to go well inland to find a bridge that they could cross and then come back up again to the beaches. And by the time they did that, it was late in the afternoon. And so their participation on the day was almost negligible, mainly because they were poorly commanded. They should have just let them get on with taking the bridges, and who knows, history may well be different.
Sure.
But But so that was the first operation, was the taking of the those bridges, and then those men had to sit there and wait. Meanwhile, on the other side, so we're back over the other side at, near Utah Beach at the base at the Cotentin Peninsula, so or the Cherbourg Peninsula, because Cherbourg is a well-known port. And American paratroopers, the 52nd, is it? The 101st American Airborne Divisions were landing there. Now, they landed several thousand troops there, and a lot of them were completely disorientated where they'd landed. They weren't sure where to go. They were not sure where they were in order to know where to go.
Sure.
But they did a very crucial thing, is they were there, and they were there ahead of the seaborne invasion, and the Germans went into that area to try and get them, to flush them out, to capture them. And again, they were diverted from where the real action was, from the beaches. So you had, at both ends, you had the German defences being distracted from the main event, from the actual invasion itself. Now, there may be reasons for that, because there had been, obviously, activity back and forth over the several years. Mm-hmm. So there was a very important but notorious and tragic event that took place at a place called Dieppe, which is a port that's a little bit further up the coast. And the Dieppe raid was in August 1942, and it was predominantly Canadian raid. And there were 6,000 men involved, and of those, half of them were casualties inside the first 10 hours. It was an absolute disaster.
Oh, wow.
And it was a way of showing, showing that particularly the Soviets that we were serious of having some sort of action to divert attention from the Eastern Front. But it was like a disastrous training exercise, effectively, and it failed miserably. There's a port near where I used to live on the south coast of England, New Haven, where many of them left from, and there's a memorial to the Canadians that died at Dieppe.
Oh,
there,
interesting.
I passed it. I used to work in New Haven, so I passed it several times. So it's a little known event, but that and other invasions that have taken place, like the American invasion of North Africa and the British and American invasions of Italy in 1943, they all were, if you like, built up the Allied knowledge of what they needed to do to surmount a really successful invasion. So they were going through these events, and they were, all the mistakes they were then realizing, the stuff that they had to think of, what they had to do in order to make this event successful. Because if D-Day failed, it would have been an absolute disaster.
Right.
Because first of all, you would have lost presumably several thousand troops in the exercise, first off. Mm-hmm. You would have lost the surprise of attacking Normandy, which was one of the best place to attack. And your high command would have been, would have had a real black mark against all of them: Eisenhower, Montgomery, sure, and even up to the likes of Roosevelt and Churchill. They would have all suffered from a failure. And it's there's a lot of people, when they look at Churchill's reluctance to go for D-Day, thinking that he didn't want it to happen. But there's a lot of history behind Churchill and seaborne invasions, and you only have to talk to an Australian or a New Zealander, because in 1915 was Gallipoli, which is in Turkey, which was Churchill's brainchild when he was in the government. Then he was head of the Admiralty then, and he planned this seaborne invasion into Turkey, and it was a disaster. Yes, and they had to basically leave in the end without any gain at all, and a lot of losses. And as a result, Anzac Day, which is the 25th of April, is the main day to commemorate for Australians and New Zealanders as all the losses that they've suffered in all wars.
Sure.
So there was a lot of history behind seaborne invasions that meant that there was some reluctance to go ahead with this, and making sure that everybody was absolutely happy with the plan, and that we all knew what we were going to do, and this is going to be a success. So I went to Normandy when I was 14. It was a school trip, and
oh, wow.
It's probably the most memorable thing I did at school. It was a great history trip. I had an American history teacher, and he took us to a place called Point de Hoc, which there's in the Normandy coast. It's on the Omaha Beach area. Mm-hmm. And there's some German bunkers. And I remember going into that bunker on a nice summer's day, and it was absolutely calm ahead of me. And I do remember looking out of that narrow slit that's ahead of you in the concrete. Uh-huh. And looking at the horizon of the channel, and just wondering how you would have felt if you were a German defender who had been in those bunkers for weeks, months, maybe years, and without anything happening. And then you wake up one morning, and in the gloom, in the early morning light, you see this mass of steaming ships coming towards you.
I can't imagine
how you would feel, because you would know that you had, this was the day of days, and it could be your last.
Probably, and it would probably be along the same lines of puking, shaking fear. Same type of thing.
It certainly were, yeah. So you have the men in the ships, and the men in those bunkers,
all
feeling
the same
exactly
way.
The same thing. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now the one thing is that a lot of those the Germans that were in the Atlantic Wall were actually relatively old. The average age of the Germans on D-Day was about 35.
Oh,
the
wow.
average age of the Allies was 21.
Yeah, young.
So there's quite a bit of difference there. And then you look at another big difference is on the resources that they had, their supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Germans had very poor supplies. Their rations were meager, and they had to sometimes beg, borrow, and steal from the local French in order to be able to eat enough to feel comfortable.
Yeah.
The British and Canadians had theirs were about gave them about 1,500 calories per day, but the Americans were extremely well fed. They had
that tradition still holds up nowadays. I can attest to that.
Their rations were about 4,500 calories. So, they had the chocolate bars, and they had the instant coffee, and they had everything. So those Americans approaching the beaches had I don't know actually if they would have had full bellies, because by the time they had crossed the channel, they might have got rid of a lot of contents of their bellies.
Yeah, 125 miles, yeah.
So even if somebody like me that doesn't really suffer from seasickness, I don't think I'd like to make that journey in those conditions.
Oh, yeah.
I've done that across on a ferry. And on a choppy day, and it's not comfortable. No,
sure,
it's certainly
sure.
not comfortable. The rising dead, faces bloated, torn, they are relieved. The living wait their turn. Your numbers up, the bullets got your name. You still go on to hell and back again. Yeah. 6:30 in the morning, the first landings took place. And yeah, that was when the real fighting took place. That's when you have all those images from, you know, the film Saving Private Ryan and those graphic images that you get from the song. You get, sure. We rush with the tide, the water is red with the blood of the dead. And mm-hmm. those sort of, that conjures up real graphic images in your mind, and you all of that was enough, that first phase of the invasion.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, certainly.
You're talking about the lyrics in the song and you know, how strong they are. Another part of it that and I have the lyrics right in front of me, but it says the world's alight, the cliffs erupt in flame, no yes. escape. Remorseless shrapnel rains, which, yes. like, if you think about that, can you imagine being down in a boat, you know, something blows up or whatever, and there's just rocks and just shrapnel coming down. And then the worst part is the next part. It says, drowning men, no chance for a warrior's fate, a yep. choking death, enter hell's gates. It's like, golly, it just makes you think about, I don't know, I'm so... War, it's just, it's so sad to think about the needless lives lost, you know?
Yeah. The terrible thing, and the thing that highlights is that Omaha Beach was the one where the most deaths took place.
Yeah.
But the one single, or the two single events that really contributed a great deal to those were two mortar bombs landing directly into landing craft. Uh-huh. And that's those words, you know, the remorseless shrapnel rains and the drowning man. Mm-hmm. That really that event with the before you've even landed on the French soil, your war is over.
Yeah,
and that's the imagery that it conjures up of bodies in the water, and it's extremely unpleasant, as you know, as war is, of course, it's something that I think we in our generation can be extremely grateful that we are not expected to be obliged to defend our homes from such a terrible tyranny that like the Nazis. We have very professional military now that thankfully do that job for us and do it extremely well.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it, and like I have my son is 17 years old, and mm-hmm. you think it's weird to think that there were kids his age, or you know, because people were lying and saying, oh, I'm 19 or I'm whatever. Because they wanted mm-hmm. to go and vanquish this evil, and
yes.
it amazes me as immature as I was at that age, and as immature as my son is at his age, it's hard to imagine people. I mean, I know, you know, patriotism and you know, for God and country and all those type of things come into play, and you can see how people can buy into that stuff, but it's amazing to think of somebody like my grandfather, and like, you know, I know your grandfather fought over there. Just thinking of people that young going mm-hmm. and living that at that age and seeing what they saw at that age, and you compare it to what we've lived, and it really, yes. like you said, it's we should be very thankful that we have literally professional armies to handle that at this point.
Yeah. And when I went to Normandy way back in 1984, yeah. As a schoolboy, 14 years old, and our teacher took us to Omaha Beach and uh-huh. took us to the American cemetery that's right on the beach. It's you just only have to walk a few steps inland, and you are in the vast cemetery at Colville.
Sure.
And I don't know if you know anything of it. I would say that any American that visits Europe ought to visit that cemetery. It is awesome in the literal sense of the word. Yeah. you stand there at the apex of the cemetery, and you look out across what were just ordinary French fields, and your view, broken up by the odd tree here and there, is of perfect rows of white crosses, going back as far as you can see, interspersed with the odd Star of David. And and there are 9,388 burials at that U.S. cemetery, not all from D-Day itself. They are from the whole of the Normandy campaign, and indeed, I think, beyond that in the rest of France. But it really does bring home the sacrifice that's made, because you look at that big picture, you look at those crosses, and you think all of these young men sailed across one vast ocean, and then across a slightly smaller bit of sea, and just to end up here.
And every one of them is, and I, you know, you have a son, I have a son. Every one of those is somebody's child.
That's right. Yes. And as a 14-year-old, you go up close and start reading the ages of those men that lie there, and they weren't much older than I was at the time. And it brings it home. So, you spend those Saturday mornings watching war films and you feeling all gung-ho and thinking, kill them, yes. And then it's a very sobering effect to look at that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we have there's a big cemetery in Arlington National Cemetery, and it's in Washington, D.C. in the United States, in the Capitol. And I've been there, and I'm sure it's got to be similar to that experience of you're just standing there, and as far as you can see, there's just white, you know, grave markers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the rest of Northern Europe, of course, is littered with the odd cemeteries. The Commonwealth, which the British and British Empire forces are in the Commonwealth cemeteries, and in the Normandy area, they tend to be smaller, but lots of them. And we visited some of those as well, but the real impact was at that American cemetery. I can tell you that. Yes, the only British equivalent I can think of is, funnily enough, at Passchendaele. Who knows?
We might imagine that.
Which is, of course, World War One, and Tynecott Cemetery there is the largest Commonwealth cemetery, and there's thousands of men memorialized there as well. You have, as I say, over 9,000 burials at that cemetery at Omaha Beach, which can give you that impression that was the sacrifice that these men made, but it wasn't there. It was throughout the whole of the Battle of Normandy. On Omaha Beach itself, there were 842 dead, as I say, is quite a lot, but it's perhaps not the figure that a lot of people would think. They would think, I thought it would have been much more than that. When you go around the corner onto Utah Beach, which is the far western end, there, the Americans had a pretty easy time of it getting onto the beaches and then advancing. But that peninsula was actually, in the end, that was more deadly, because the land inland of that is notorious. It's lots of hedgerows and lots of banks and ditches, and the Americans found that extremely hard going through that land, and their job was to turn northwards, effectively to go back where they came from, but to turn north up to the peninsula and take the port of Cherbourg from behind. So Cherbourg was attacked from behind rather than in front, and that was to get for the Allies to get themselves a seaport, because they knew that they weren't going to be able to get a seaport on the day itself. They decided to bring that one with them. And so part of that building up the preparations for D-Day was to build a harbour and sail it across the channel and to build it at Aramanche, right in the middle of the beach, the whole of the series of beaches. And that was called the Mulberry Harbour. It's basically, there are sections of concrete and steel that were all linked together to build a temporary harbour that the Allies could then bring in their supplies straight away. Not only supply with, you needed food, you needed fuel, you needed guns, you needed tanks, you needed men.
Yeah.
Because not only were, you had all the landings on the day itself, but on the days after, you had to keep pumping men into Normandy. They had to keep coming in order to make sure that you not only held the ground, but you were able to advance into France.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Mulberry Harbour at Aramanche was extremely important, vital to ensuring that the days beyond D-Day were a success. And not only that, they also brought with them a pipeline for fuel. And that was called the Pipeline Under the Ocean, or abbreviated to Pluto. So that pumped fuel from Britain straight into France. And so Allies were constantly supplied and ensuring the constant success of the day itself. Now, one of the great costs, which is often forgotten about the Battle of Normandy, is the cost on the French themselves, because obviously they were living there at the time and they didn't know anything about it as much as the Germans amongst them. And part of the invasion was a massive aerial assault on Normandy. I think there was about 11,000 aircraft involved a huge operation to bomb the defences of Normandy, to ensure that any advance particularly from panzer divisions was roads, etc., were attacked. The city of Caen itself suffered hugely. Which is just a few miles inland from the beaches. Mm-hmm. And that really, thousands died in the city from Allied bombing.
Wow.
In the context of the Second World War at the time, that was considered to be a price worth paying. I think today we would think very differently about it.
Oh, yeah.
But in those days it was, either we do this or we're going to lose our own men who are vital to the success of winning the war, or we're going to fail. So, that was part of the cost of a successful invasion and winning the war what they call collateral damage, I think it's called, isn't it? That euphemism, which is,
Imagine being the person, and there was probably more than one of them, but having to count that cost and say, here's what it's going to cost us, not something with a dollar sign in front of it, something with human faces in front of it.
Indeed. Yes. And of course, the the people in Britain in particular have been paying a similar price for under the Blitz and being bombed out. And then subsequently, yeah. Of course, in Germany, German cities were obliterated, many of them from Allied bombing. So really, I think that World War II is, as far as Europe's concerned, was really a war where everybody was involved. It wasn't just the military. Yeah. Everybody played their part and paid a price. It was something I don't think we'll ever see again. Is a war as total as World War II was, particularly in Europe.
Yeah, yeah, the level of the type of fighting that was going on, and nowadays it would be something probably nuclear or something like that.
Well, yes, of course, technology has advanced so much, and of course, so the need for ploughing many men, conscripting men into fighting is not anywhere near what it now is.
Yeah.
It's not where it was in World War II, certainly. Yes, I mean we had so the day itself, as I say, 11,000 aircraft, 7,000 vessels on the sea, and 160,000 troops on the day itself. And as I say, after that, they kept pumping more and more men into Normandy to win the Battle of Normandy itself, and then liberate Paris, and then of course to go on to liberate the rest of Europe. Whilst in the meantime, of course, the Soviets were advancing from the east towards Berlin. So the race to Berlin had started on D-Day itself.
Yeah, it's obviously, yeah, it was a huge. I mean, it's like you said, it's a key piece. The amount of lives that, you know, like you said, in the context of when you think of a world war, that doesn't, you think, oh, that's all.
Mm.
But then you think of, like I said, every one of those people has a mom and a dad and probably brothers and sisters back home.
Yep.
That just didn't. Maybe they didn't realize the full aspect, the full possible cost. They just thought, okay, you know, it's going to be a go over there and be a part of it, and they'll be back home in a couple of months, and little did they know that they'd never see him again.
Indeed. Now, one of the interesting lines from the song is when it talks about Valhalla waits and Valkyries rise and fall and warrior tombs lie open for us all. And that really intrigued me when I started to look at the song. And Valhalla, I don't know if you know what Valhalla is.
Is Valhalla the is it supposed to be a like the river down that separates hell or something?
No, it's in Norse mythology, so Viking mythology, and it's the Hall of the Slain. Oh. So for a Viking warrior, Valhalla was the place where they wished to end up, because they would die a warrior's death in battle, and they would go and they would sit with Odin in the Hall of the Slain in Valhalla, and the Valkyries were the ones that selected those men that were to die and to go to Valhalla. Of course, so that's a warrior's faith. The thing that intrigues me about that is that Normandy is named after the Norsemen, because Normandy was a Viking settlement. The reason why it's called Normandy is because it comes from the Northmen, the men from the north, the Vikings, the Norse. And so Normandy, way back a couple of thousand years ago, was this colony effectively of Norsemen. And so you have this Viking mythology in the song connecting with Normandy being having been a Norse settlement in northern France. Uh-huh. And another one of those little things, that little circles that history sometimes throws up. Mm-hmm. The man who devised D-Day was the British General Montgomery, Bernard Montgomery. And he was the hero of Alamein, which is in North Africa, where the British managed to turn the Germans around in North Africa away and defend Egypt and the Suez Canal, which was absolutely vital to British interests in particular, but mm-hmm. to the war effort, certainly. And so they managed to turn, Montgomery turned them around in North Africa. And he, after the success in North Africa, he was the man who devised D-Day. He comes in for a bit of criticism. Mm-hmm. But Montgomery was a direct descendant from a gentleman by the name of Roger de Montgomery, okay. who was part of William of Normandy's invasion fleet. He was a senior member of William's invasion in 1066, which left Normandy to invade England, to win the crown of England. So Montgomery had gone from Normandy to England, and then 900 years later, his descendant returns to Normandy to liberate Europe. So I like those little bits where history can connect over hundreds of years between, you know, descendant from one man to another.
That's crazy. It's,
yes. So, I mean, that's my basic overview of Normandy. And I would say to anybody, if you get the chance, visit Normandy. Normandy is a beautiful part of France. I've not really explored France too much, but I have been to Normandy two or three times, and I think it's a beautiful part of Europe, and it is an area that is just so full of history and interest, because you not only go to Normandy and you can visit the beaches. This is history that, you know, you and I would have, you know, had family members that we've sat down and talked to, that were in World War II, that knew were lived there. But we have a living history of World War II. But we can go and visit those places. We can see, the different beaches, the views that those invading and defending would have had on that day. But you only have to travel to a little bit inland to a place called Bayeux, and at Bayeux in Normandy, just back from the beaches, is the Bayeux Tapestry, which is a long embroidery, I think it is, not tapestry, but it's called the Bayeux Tapestry. And that is a pictorial depiction of the Norman invasion of England, going through stage by stage.
Oh, wow.
And so, again, you have that connection across the channel between Normandy and England that has gone back hundreds of years. And the Dukes of Normandy became the Kings of England, and English interest in Europe lasted for several hundred years until the 1500s when Calais was lost, our last holding in France. So there's a long history there of cross-channel interests, shall we say?
Yeah.
Of which D-Day is by a long way the most important and the most significant, and I think it is still today the largest ever seaborne invasion that's ever taken place. It was just a magnificent achievement at great cost, but the cost of not doing it and the cost of failing was far, far greater. And I think we should all be grateful for those that are still lie in Normandy today and those that were able to come back and tell their story.
Yeah, you think about it. You think that these people, and this really boggles my mind because I never can wrap my head around this for myself or for my, you know, having a son. I can't imagine somebody. It's really weird to think about a person being willing to give the ultimate sacrifice. And, you know, you hear that phrase, oh, the ultimate, he gave the ultimate sacrifice. But if you really kind of stop and just think about it, you think, wow, I mean, you're really, all you have, everything that you have is, I mean, everything that I have is sitting right here in this chair as far as, you know, my personal life. And to think that I would go, you know what, I'm going to get up. And, you know, of course, we would do that for our family or something along those lines. But to think that I'm going to go and do this and just the people were, and I'm sure that everybody, you know, didn't realize what they were doing, but it was very selfless. And you know, it's amazing to think of how selfless those people were to do that, to give that up, to give their lives up.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's the young men who have nothing to lose, but they don't usually have a family. They don't have a wife or a child or anything like that. So they, and as a younger man, you are maybe a bit more hot-headed, a bit more willing to get into a dust up than you are when you're older. And that's a fact of the Allies' age of 21, and then the Germans were 30, average age of 35, and some of them apparently Rommel met a gunner in an emplacement on the Atlantic Wall that was 58. And wow. You have got something to look. You've lived a bit of life, and you will have a wife and a child, and you'll be thinking, you know, I want to see them again, and maybe you don't fight quite with the same vigor that a youngster of 18, 20, whatever, may well fight. I don't know, because never having been in that situation, I couldn't say, but that would be my assumption anyway.
And it sounds like the Germans were really almost like they were smug. They were, you know, they had so many victories before that.
I don't know if they were so much smug rather than stretched. They had an Eastern Front that was a nightmare for them, that they had been turned around at Stalingrad in, I think, 1943, and they were being pushed back by the Soviets back into Poland towards Germany again. They were massive pressure there.
I guess I was thinking of is where you talked about the one guy was spending time with a lady, one guy was drunk, and another guy went home for a while, you know? It seems like they just kind of thought, well, you know, we've managed it. We managed to stay where we're at, and they weren't expecting defeat.
Yeah, I think one thing that really struck me from looking into this is I think you've got to certainly separate the German fighting man from the German command. There was a great deal of incompetence amongst the German command, as far as I can make out. These were men that were, occasionally very poorly led. The British and the Americans and the Canadians, they didn't maybe have really crack units like some of the Germans were.
Yeah,
but they were nowhere near as bad as a lot of the Germans. So they were like a constant, rather than the Germans being, you know, some good, some really good, some really bad. But of course, you have to remember is one of the real problems for Germany was the fact that they were being hemmed in. They weren't getting the supplies to the front that they needed. You know, simple things like food for their troops. And if you're not being able to, that's one of the major reasons why Germany lost World War One, was because they were completely hemmed in and were unable. They had lost any control of the seas and were unable to get any supplies in whatsoever. And it was the same again in World War Two, and they had stretched themselves way beyond their capabilities, and they were paying a heavy price. And they were at the very top of the German chain of command was a bloke who was really, one hesitates to say mad, but he was not a competent commander of a massive army. And I think we can feel very, very fortunate that the Allies were coming across, the German command system that was broken, that was full of jealousies and full of rivalries. And when you think of the Allied command system, which was largely three different countries, Britain, Canada, the United States. Whilst we all speak English, we don't necessarily always understand each other, and you have all these different people coming together from different parts of the world, and yet their command structure worked so much more smoothly. No doubt it had the rivalries, had those jealousies in there, but they were focused on the main aim rather than their own, you know, petty differences, whereas the German command system was completely different. And that's from the studying I've done, that is the one thing that really struck me as a key vital difference between the Allies and the Germans.
Interesting. Which, you know, thank God for that. You know, thank God that they had incompetence up there, because, you know, like you said, who knows what the world would look like otherwise at this point.
Some incompetence and some misfortune. I mean, Rommel was a very competent general, but he just was absent at the time. So there weren't all fools, but there, you know, there were people that there. Yes.
They always say, you know, that everything flows from the top. So no matter how competent the people underneath the leader are, if the leader is not competent, then ultimately. Yes. It's what's going to end up that way.
Well, simple things. I think I'm right in saying that the Panzer divisions, their command chain went directly to Hitler himself. Uh-huh. And they needed direction from Berlin before they made any major decisions. And so they had to wait a long time before they're being told to move into position to properly defend. So that's vital. Hours that are lost.
That's ignorance,
if you're trying to win a key battle. Mm.
It's a combination. It's a combination of ignorance and arrogance, you know?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, indeed. So. Yes, yes.
Well, I'll tell you.
Before we finish, I think it's important that I credit the two gentlemen that have helped me gather all this information together. And there's a couple of books I'd just like to recommend, which is Sand and Steel, A New History of D-Day by Peter Caddick Adams, and Normandy 44, D-Day and the Battle for France. And that was by, I have his name somewhere, I should have written it down, Holland, James Holland, that's it.
James Holland.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to have far more detailed and far more competent explanation of the events of D-Day and what went on, then I would recommend those two books, certainly.
Well, there was a lot of – I mean, you really gave a lot of detail. And I don't know. I'm looking through the lyrics here. I just wanted to read a couple of them, if that's okay. Just a couple things I like. There's some. It says the rising dead faces bloated and torn. They are relieved. The living wait their turn.
Mm.
Your number's up. The bullet's got your name. You'll still go on to hell and back again.
Yes.
You know, and of course the line where he says, the water is red with the blood of the dead, but I'm still alive. I just pray to God I survive. You know, it's amazing to think that these people went through this, and you know, the ones that lived through it, you know, many didn't, but many did. And it's an incredible thing to think, like I said, I guess the whole thing I said earlier about people just being willing, but, ultimately I will say this, that was very interesting, and I really appreciate you doing the research and citing your sources. You know, that way,
yes.
You know, you sent me a message the other day, and you said you felt like you were studying at school. So, you know, my son, he was taking a class recently and at school, and he got a really bad grade on this thing, and he says, "Well, I didn't list my sources." Or he didn't something like that, and he basically went, you know, got he failed the assignment for that reason. So good thing, because you know you were on the verge of failing your assignment. So
I was, wasn't I? And I thought I better. I wanted to mention it because I think that it's important that those people who I've got a great deal of this information from were credited because they're the ones that did the real work. And
yeah,
I just regurgitated it.
Well, I like I say, I appreciate you putting in the time and doing that, because it was very interesting, and I look forward to more, and I'm sure other people will as well. So thank you very much for your time and for taking the lead in doing this.
That's quite all right. I had a thoroughly enjoyable time doing all the research, even though it was hard work, of course.
Awesome. Well, thank you, sir. Have yourself a good rest of your night.
Thank you very much, and you too.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. Well, there you have it. The real story of the longest day. Much, much, much thanks to my friend and man of many nicknames, Andrew Whitnall. This certainly could not and would not have happened without you, Andrew. So now the clock is on for the next one. No pressure. I really do appreciate it, though, sir, in all seriousness. I really, really do. Now, if you are wondering how to support Uncle Steve on his journey across the world to meet some of you, I'm very slow and getting things done slowly. My wife always says procrastinate should be my middle name, so that's probably what it is. I've practically got it all done. It's just a matter of getting the little last bit done. So, should be coming soon. Now, I do appreciate your patience. I really do. On behalf of myself, on behalf of Andrew, the weekend warrior, Georgie's dad, Sonia's husband, the man of many nicknames, Whitnall, from Iron Maiden, from Eddie, and from the boys, good night.
Who do you think you are? kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run. We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again. 'Cause who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think old England's done? Mr. Brown goes off to town on the A21, but he comes home each evening and he's ready with his gun. So who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler?